Pick your poison. I'm Joseph. This is Input English. Today we have a discussion based on something that happened last night. More specifically, it happened in the early morning hours, what we might call the wee hours of the night, the small hours. And it happened here. It was dark outside, and I was sound asleep. For some reason, I woke up, and within a few seconds of being awake, the room started to shake. It took me a fraction of a second to know that it was an earthquake. I have experienced many earthquakes over decades, and so when an earthquake occurs, I quickly figure out that it's an earthquake. So that's what happened. Why did I start out by saying pick your poison? Well, let's dive into that expression. It's a part of American and British English that dates back to the 19th century, and it appears that it developed in drinking establishments, in bars, pubs. A lot of people consider the beverages served in bars and pubs to be not good for people, therefore poisonous. It appears that in the 19th century, from time to time, one would arrive in one of those establishments and the bartender would ask you to pick your poison. Which of these beverages would you like? It's a sarcastic, wry expression. As is often the case, expressions that develop in a certain area or in a certain industry frequently get picked up by popular culture and used more generally. In the 21st century, if someone picks their poison, that use is usually figurative, and it refers to choosing between two or more undesirable options. During a lot of my life, I lived on the East Coast, and quite a bit of that time was spent in Florida. In Florida, the natural disaster that quickly comes to mind is the hurricane. We grew up with the occasional threat of hurricanes coming through our area. We became familiar with that threat. We also became familiar with the behavior that mitigates the risk of hurricanes. When I moved to the West Coast, I moved away from the hurricanes, but I moved into an area where earthquakes are fairly common. I had only been in Los Angeles a couple of weeks before I experienced an earthquake. Now, interestingly enough, that was not the first earthquake I had experienced. A year or so earlier, while I was living in Cleveland, I was at work and we had an earthquake. The building shook. It was very unusual, and I quickly figured out that it was an earthquake. Earthquakes in Ohio are uncommon. So when I came out of that office and announced to coworkers that we had just had an earthquake, they met my analysis with complete disbelief. They knew that we didn't have earthquakes in Ohio, and they assumed I was speaking nonsense. However, we checked the news, and indeed it was an earthquake. That was the first earthquake I had ever experienced and knew it was an earthquake at the time. While living in California, earthquakes are not daily occurrences, but they're common enough that they're familiar. Over the years, talking to friends, acquaintances, family members, the question arises whether I would prefer to live in an area where there's a hurricane threat or an earthquake threat. Really, they're apples and oranges. They're not the same type of threat. I suppose I would prefer to live in California with the threat of an occasional earthquake, but I never dealt with either of these threats of natural disaster as a big part of the choice where I was going to live. People adapt to all sorts of different environments. For someone living in Florida, they can mitigate their risk of problems from hurricanes by choosing where they live. People in Central Florida are less likely to have problems with flooding. Tidal surge doesn't usually come 50 miles inland. On the other hand, if someone lives directly on the beach, if they have a beach house, then flooding, inundation of their home, would be foreseeable in the event of a hurricane. Sometimes in beach communities, you will see the houses built up on stilts. They will insert pilings into the ground and then build the first floor of this beach house one story up. They might have parking for their cars underneath, but they don't have a living space at ground level because they can predict that a tidal surge, a flood, could ruin everything by flooding their home. In all of the places I lived in Florida, I was inland, so I didn't give much thought to hurricane threat of tidal surge and flooding. Some people need to think about that. We also put some thought process into preparation for earthquakes. Those of us who live in California are wise to do that. When we bought this house, the realtor actually addressed that topic specifically. This realtor had shown us homes in various neighborhoods in this general area. She always applied a critique to the home in terms of earthquake preparedness. She advised that we consider this house because this house is located on several different roads, so if one needed to escape this area because of a natural disaster, a fire or earthquake, there are several roads that you could use to accomplish that escape. She cautioned us against buying a home to which there was only one road. She pointed out that if that road was blocked by a mudslide, a fire, or some other result of a natural disaster, we could be trapped. She said this house was good because we're much less likely to be trapped. When thinking about these things, I think in terms of preparedness rather than just agonizing over the fear of some potential future natural disaster. I don't want to live in fear. I want to be ready for something that might happen or probably will happen in the future. In the case of earthquakes, it happened last night. Now, this was not a devastating earthquake. I have surveyed the entire house and outside the house, and I see no evidence of damage. I see no evidence that anything fell over. I don't see any evidence that anything cracked or separated. There's no change in the contour of the land around the house. In terms of physical evidence, nothing happened. But in terms of the human sensation, something definitely happened. I was surprised that it appeared to me that I woke up before the earthquake, just before the earthquake. There may have been some preliminary movement before the big part of the earthquake. It seems likely that it was the earthquake that woke me up. But my sensation was that I was awake and then the earthquake occurred. People report their sensation of movement when they experience earthquakes. They use a lot of different terms. They might describe an earthquake as a jolt. They might describe it as rattling. In California, people often describe earthquakes as rolling in their nature, a smooth, wave-like sensation. When we were living in Sacramento, we didn't have a lot of earthquakes, but the one that comes to mind was the big 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. The epicenter of that earthquake was only a few miles from this house. We felt that huge earthquake in Sacramento. I was in a small office. I was talking to two people at the time, and we all had a sensation of seasickness. We noticed that something was wrong. The shades on the windows started banging against the windows, and we had this queasy feeling like we were getting seasick. It was like being on a boat. It was definitely a rolling boat-like experience, and it lasted several seconds. During the earthquake, we actually talked about what was happening. One of us quickly said, "Oh wow, this is an earthquake." We were over 100 miles from the epicenter, and there was no damage in Sacramento that I recall. There was no damage locally, but I definitely remember that it was a rolling, boat-like seasickness sensation that we got when we experienced that earthquake. Last night, it was a very sharp series of jolts. I was in bed. I got the sensation that the bed and the room were going up and down very quickly. A series of up and down movements. There was sound as the house was rattled. I immediately knew it was an earthquake. Over the years, the recommendations to the public on what to do during an earthquake have evolved. They've changed. And the problem for citizens is we frequently learned the old guidelines that have now evolved into new guidelines. I'm not certain that I'm up to date on what to do. Last night, it really didn't matter because the earthquake duration was so short that there was no time for me to do anything. Had I wanted to get out of bed, run outside, protect myself in a doorway, cover my head with a pillow, none of those options was really available because of the short duration of the earthquake. It was over before I had a chance to respond. The one thing I did for sure was look at the clock. I have a digital clock in the bedroom, and it's in view of the bed. So I looked at the clock and got a timestamp. I wanted to know when this earthquake occurred. I keep that clock set very accurately. I set it to the time standard that I get off my cell phone. I don't want that clock to be off by minutes. I want it to be accurate. So when the earthquake occurred last night, I quickly looked up and made a note that it was 1:41 a.m. I would use that information after I got up to look up that earthquake and see how powerful it was, where the epicenter was, and whether there was any damage anywhere. I formed the opinion, based on the sharp up and down sensation of the earthquake, that the epicenter was close by. I assume that if the epicenter is far away, the sensation will be more rolling in nature, smoother movements. I assume that the sharp jolt nature of that earthquake suggested that it was close, and I was correct. It was only a few miles from this house. So I established my timestamp, but that time, 1:41 a.m., was Pacific Daylight Time. I suspected that this earthquake would probably be reported in UTC. What's that? UTC is a fun topic. So let's briefly talk about time standards. In the pre-industrial world, time was local. During much of human history, people didn't have timepieces. They didn't have clocks. Once clocks were invented, they were frequently owned by institutions or wealthy people, and regular people didn't necessarily have clocks until they were more mass-produced. In the United States, if a town had a clock, it would usually be set based on local apparent noon. Someone would observe when it was noon based on the position of the sun, and then the clock would be set to noon, and that would maintain the local time standard. That worked very well for small towns or cities until the development of the Industrial Revolution, because that's when rail travel and telegraph communication became possible. Telegraphy, that is the use of a telegraph system and rail systems, required a more precise time standard. And for a country the size of the United States, that was a problem because the time in New York, the time in Ohio, and the time in California weren't really the same time based on the position of the sun. The two industries that had a lot to do with early time regulation in the United States were the telegraph system and the rail system. While all of this was happening in the United States, it was also happening worldwide. As technology improved and our ability to more precisely measure time improved, regional time standards were adopted. The prime meridian was established in Greenwich, England, and this was the longitude from which other time zones could be calculated. You might have heard the term Greenwich Mean Time. That is the time that it would be in Greenwich, England, at the prime meridian. The International Telegraphic Union played a role in developing agreements about time standards. The field of this organization was telegraphy, that is, the use of telegraphic equipment to send messages. However, with the development of additional technology, that International Telegraphic Union changed into the International Telecommunication Union. This occurred as radio communication and television got folded into the mix. They realized that as they labeled a time standard, they needed to do so very concisely, so they searched for a proper abbreviation. In English, that time standard that referenced the prime meridian was called Coordinated Universal Time. That could be easily abbreviated CUT. The trouble with that is, in English, CUT is a word to cut, to slice something, to divide something. So it was anticipated that referring to Coordinated Universal Time as cut could be ambiguous, could be troublesome. The French words for this expression begin with the letters T-U-C. I'm not going to try to attempt to pronounce the French. I am not good in that language yet. Perhaps someday. But T-U-C would be the French abbreviation. Again, this could be a problem. The International Telecommunications Union decided on a compromise between these two abbreviations. These were true abbreviations, English and French, and they wanted to identify Coordinated Universal Time with a label that would not be ambiguous. They chose UTC. Now, the funny thing about UTC is that it is not an abbreviation of anything. It is a compromise between the English expression and the French expression, and UTC is its own expression. It's not an abbreviation. So what is the difference between Greenwich Mean Time and UTC? Are they the same? Well, not exactly. In the 21st century, you can think of Greenwich Mean Time as a time zone. It is the time zone that includes Greenwich, England. We should consider UTC as a time standard. It is related to the movement of the Earth, the rotation of the Earth. It certainly references that, but it's not determined by that. UTC is defined by an atomic clock. It is a time standard. And then from time to time, it is adjusted so that UTC will correspond to the observable time on Earth based on the rotation of the Earth. This is accomplished with the occasional application of a leap second. They have the ability, by convention, to omit or theoretically add a second from time to time to adjust the time standard so that it matches the rotation of the Earth. So when I looked at the clock at 1:41 a.m., it was 8:41 UTC. UTC is an expression for Coordinated Universal Time, and it's not an abbreviation. So you could easily anticipate that UTC would be a great way to express time if the endeavor, if the activity involves various time zones, such as air travel. Indeed, that is the case. Airlines, air traffic control, various functions in the aviation system worldwide reference UTC. So you might anticipate that occasionally a pilot or an air traffic controller would specify a time and say UTC, but they don't. The military and aviation tend to use Zulu. When I was trained as a pilot, I learned to refer to something in Zulu time. So why is it called Zulu time? Does this have anything to do with the Zulu people who speak Bantu in Africa? And the answer is no. We get the word Zulu from the NATO phonetic alphabet. When people started to communicate with each other on radios, one of the problems that was encountered was ambiguity. People would misunderstand an expression because of the similarity in the sounds of the language. In early aviation and in the military, a phonetic alphabet was developed, and you might occasionally hear an expression that suggests the use of that old phonetic alphabet. The old phonetic alphabet, A, was designated as Abel, and B was designated as Baker. So if you hear someone, for instance, in an old movie, talking in jargon saying Abel Baker, meaning A-B, that's the old phonetic alphabet. That was the phonetic alphabet that was used in World War II. So if you're watching a movie depicting activities in World War II, and they use a phonetic alphabet, they should be using the old version, and some of the expressions would include Abel Baker. However, in 1956, NATO created a modern phonetic alphabet. This is the standard phonetic alphabet used by militaries and by the aviation industry. A pilot in 2026 is not going to say Abel Baker. They're going to say Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot, Golf, Hotel, Indigo, and Juliet. Those are the first 10 letters of the alphabet in the phonetic alphabet, the modern version. That has not changed since 1956. So why are we talking about this phonetic alphabet? Well, the letter Z in the phonetic alphabet is Zulu. If A is Alpha, Z, the last letter in the English alphabet, is Zulu. And Zulu can be thought of as the zero meridian, the Greenwich meridian. Zero. So in aviation, rather than saying UTC, they'll say Zulu time. And Zulu time is just a very concise way of referring to UTC. Even though we got the term Zulu from zero from Greenwich, it actually means UTC. It refers to the Coordinated Universal Time. Now, I'm aware of all this. I'm not a fanatic about this. Local time in this house works fine. The clocks here are set to either Pacific Standard Time or Pacific Daylight Time. Right now, it's Pacific Daylight Time. When we use Daylight Time in California, Coordinated Universal Time, UTC, does not change. But the difference between UTC and local California time changes by 1 hour. I think this business of communication, time zones, communication with each other concisely but precisely is just fascinating. Unfortunately, it can seem like alphabet soup. So there's an expression in English, probably American English primarily. In the middle part of the 20th century, companies made canned soups. They made consumer products, including food. And when I was growing up, you could buy a can of soup called alphabet soup. This was marketed for the entertainment of children. The pasta in this soup product was in the form of little letters, small letters. And when you were eating your soup, you could pick up one or more letters on your spoon and pronounce the letters. You could say, wow, this bite has an A, a P, and a Z. And then you eat it. You could actually buy dried pasta that had this mixture of alphabetical characters that you could put in your soup that you made in your own kitchen, that is, homemade. I can remember as a kid, I rather liked alphabet soup. As an adult, I don't eat it. It's processed food. When we say alphabet soup in the 21st century, we're talking about perhaps unintelligible, confusing use of letters in combinations that are hard to figure out. You might have experienced that as I talked today. I talked about Coordinated Universal Time, and then I called it UTC. You might have looked at my use of UTC as jargon, as being confusing, unfamiliar, and you might think of it in terms of alphabet soup, just meaningless letters, the significance of which are hard to figure out. A lot of government publications, to my eye, amount to alphabet soup. You see a bunch of jargon, a bunch of abbreviations, and quickly you lose the ability to figure out what they're talking about. Really, if something amounts to alphabet soup in this figurative way, it amounts to failure to communicate. I've tried to make things clear and interesting and avoid the downside of alphabet soup. But there are more abbreviations to be had here. What about the USGS? Well, I certainly got involved with them today. When I woke up, I went about my business. I set the thermostat to warm the house up a little bit because it's cold outside. And I let the house cool down overnight. I started heating the water for the coffee. And pretty soon I was checking online to see what had transpired. I went to the website of the USGS. That's an abbreviation for an agency in the United States called the United States Geological Survey. They are the agency that has the expertise to monitor earthquakes and report to us what has occurred. They have a very robust series of websites all connected related to what they do in that agency. When I logged on to the USGS website, I quickly saw the big news of the day, which was a significant earthquake, magnitude 4.6, in Boulder Creek, California. Boulder Creek is a few miles that way. It's not very far from here. As the crow flies, that is, directly, it is probably less than 10 miles. The epicenter of that earthquake was reported to be about a kilometer to the east and south of the town of Boulder Creek in the Santa Cruz Mountains. This house is in the Santa Cruz Mountains. The depth of that earthquake was reported at about 10.5 kilometers deep. It was deep in the crust of the earth. It was not a surface phenomenon. We felt it, but the shift of the tectonic plate, the energy released by that shift, occurred about 10 kilometers deep. In American English, if we have letters that are used as an abbreviation, we have to make the choice whether we use them as letters like USGS or whether we try to turn them into a word and pronounce them as if they were a word. There's no easy rule for this. The safest thing to do is to just state the letters, USGS. I've never heard anybody call that USGS or USGS. That doesn't happen. That would actually be very confusing if you referred to the U.S. Geological Service as USGS. As the language evolves, people make their choice whether to pronounce an abbreviation or just state the letters. In medicine, for instance, there is a germ that was described as methicillin-resistant staph aureus. The abbreviation is MRSA, and for decades, that is the way it was said. Over time, one would occasionally hear someone refer to MRSA as MRSA. The first time I heard that, I was a little surprised. There are a lot of abbreviations that are pronounced routinely. In the United States, the National Aeronautics Space Administration is abbreviated NASA. But nobody calls it NASA. They call it NASA. There's an abbreviation that is routinely pronounced as if it's a word. If you go to a bank machine, you might need to enter your card and then provide a personal identification number, PIN. But nobody calls it a PIN, they call it a PIN. You enter your PIN, and then you get access to your bank account. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is always called NATO. In law enforcement, Special Weapons and Tactics, SWAT, is always pronounced SWAT. There are a lot of abbreviations that you never pronounce as if they are a word. In aviation, there is a navigation system abbreviated VOR, but you would never call it a VOR. There's another navigation system called NDB, and you would never try to pronounce that. These conventions of whether to pronounce an abbreviation as if it was a word develop organically. It's not like there are regulations we have to memorize and follow. This is a clear example of learning it from input, getting a feel for the language, and then using your intuition, your instinct, to proceed. It's okay to make a mistake from time to time. As I investigated that earthquake and organized my thoughts about what I was going to talk to you about here on today's video, I came across an article in the Sacramento Bee. I used to live in Sacramento, and I used to subscribe to the Sacramento Bee. Back in the day, it was delivered to a little box next to our mailbox, and I had a habit of reading the newspaper every day. Times have changed. I like the Sacramento Bee. The organization that publishes it is called the McClatchy Organization. McClatchy refers to the family that started that paper. I was amused at what was written at the bottom of an article published by the Sacramento Bee. Let me read it to you. It's really charming. This article was generated by the CA Earthquake Bot. software that analyzes structured information, such as data, and applies it to articles based on templates created by journalists in the newsroom. No human journalist was harmed in this experiment. You can report errors or bugs to McClatchybot. As I read that, I was completely amused. First of all, the syntax sounds like it was written by a robot. It was not very natural in the way those sentences were strung together. It seemed like that was output from an AI. But it was charming how that AI chose, based on its programming, to insert a little joke that no journalist was harmed in this experiment. The jokesters of the world can think up jokes, they can tell jokes, they can write jokes, or in this case, they can program a joke into the output of an AI. Welcome to the 21st century. Well, after the earthquake that occurred at 8:41 UTC, a few miles from here, I see no evidence of damage. I was able to get back to sleep, and then upon surveying the household and the neighborhood, I didn't see any damage at all. So as I choose my poison, hurricanes versus earthquakes, I suppose I would prefer the earthquakes. I invite comments below, and if you like videos like this, be sure to click on this one next. See you soon.